did Russian President Vladimir Putin threaten former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson?
Boris, I don't want to hurt you, but with a missile, it would only take a minute.
Plus, does South Africa have a diplomatic role to play to end the war?
Consistency and character are missing from South Africa's contradictory stance on the Ukraine war.
And later in the program, an update from Kyiv and a conversation with a U.S. congressperson about supplying Ukraine with planes and how to thwart a coming Russian spring offensive. Today is Monday, January 30th. From the Voice of America in Washington, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish. Former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has said Russian President Vladimir Putin once threatened him with a missile strike during a phone call in the run-up to the invasion of Ukraine. Johnson, speaking to the BBC for a documentary, said Putin had asked him about the prospects of Ukraine joining NATO, to which he responded that it would not be for the foreseeable future. Russia was and still is opposed to Ukraine joining NATO, and that's when the threat came.
You know, he threatened me at one point and said, you know, Boris, I don't want to hurt you, but with a missile, it would only take a minute or something like that, you know.
Johnson added that he felt Putin wasn't taking his advice not to invade Ukraine and to negotiate seriously.
But I think from the very relaxed tone that he was taking, the sort of air of detachment that he seemed to have, he was just playing along with my attempts to get him to negotiate.
Not surprisingly, the Kremlin vehemently denies this. Dmitry Peskov is Kremlin spokesperson.
No, what Mr. Johnson said is not true. More specifically, it is a lie. And what's more, I'll tell you, it is either a deliberate lie, in which case you'll have to ask Mr. Johnson why he chose to put it that way, or it was an unconscious lie, and he did not, in fact, understand what Putin was talking to him about.
Peskov says that Putin had explained to Johnson how, if Ukraine joined NATO, then NATO missiles could reach Moscow in a matter of minutes, and suggested that there may have been a misunderstanding.
Talking about the challenges for the Russian Federation, President Putin noted that if Ukraine joined NATO and NATO or U.S. missiles were deployed near our borders, it would mean that any missile would reach Moscow within minutes.
Relations between Moscow and London had shrunk to their lowest level in decades, even before Russia invaded Ukraine, on the back of the poisoning of former Russian spy Sergei Skripal in the British city of Salisbury in 2018. As the war shows no signs of coming to an end soon, Europe is cutting more energy ties with Russia. AP correspondent Charles Della Desma has the story.
Europe's cutting more energy ties with Russia. A ban on imports of diesel fuel and other products made from crude oil in Russian refineries takes effect on February 5. The goal is to stop feeding Russia's war chest with energy payments. But it's not so simple. Diesel prices have already jumped since the war started on February 24, 2022, and they could rise again. The ban's likely to be accompanied by a price cap, and the uncertainty of how that will work has markets on edge. Depending on how the cap is applied, flows of diesel could reshuffle after temporarily higher prices, with Europe finding new suppliers in the US, Middle East, and Asia. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
In a related story, energy has been one of the biggest news stories of the war. Either the Russian targeting of Ukraine's civilian energy production, or as we just heard, the disruption to Europe's energy markets. Now, in an attempt to break the will of the people, Russia's war against Ukraine is increasingly targeting the civilian population and the country's electricity infrastructure. But huge power ships from Turkey could help thwart Russia's goal, as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Russia's latest attack on Ukrainian civilians not only targeted their homes, the streets of Ukraine are constantly plunged into darkness as Russian forces relentlessly hit Ukraine's electricity infrastructure.
Right now, what we are seeing is that they are doing this in order to kill as many Ukrainians as possible, but in a kind of indirect way, by creating the unbearable conditions for life without electricity, heating, and water.
But the Turkey-based company, Kar Powerships, says it can help alleviate Ukraine's energy crisis. Its powerships operate worldwide, including in hotspots like Beirut, and can supply millions of homes with electricity.
We have been in contact with Ukrenergo since August last year, and with the Odessa governorate as well. We could potentially place 300 megawatt ships, so totaling 300 megawatts, in various ports in Odessa, and 100 megawatt could power the Odessa port and its related facilities. The others could power the related residential areas around Odessa.
With many of Ukraine's power stations targeted by Russian forces, energy generators are urgently needed.
Currently, the biggest problem of Ukrainian power system is the lack of generation. So many thermal and hydropower plants were damaged or destroyed, so we cannot, unfortunately, cover the consumption. And this is the biggest problem, and this is the reason why we have these rolling power cuts all over the country.
Protecting the power ships remains a significant obstacle, says Kar Power. Ankara has maintained good relations with Moscow, but it's unclear whether the goodwill extends to the protection of the ships. Kar Power says they are looking for solutions.
Now we are in communications with various aid parties. Some are US originated, and also with Moldova authorities and Romanian authorities to also evaluate the possibility of placing the ships in Romania or Moldova, and then transmitting the electricity to Ukraine.
Kar Powerships says that with some of its ships already close by, they could be supplying Ukraine with electricity within 30 days. But payment could be the biggest obstacle.
The question is who will pay for these services, whether it's the Ukrainian government or a kind of international agency. So these details are not clear.
But time is not on Kyiv's side, as Russian forces are predicted to step up their assault on Ukraine's infrastructure, just as the worst of winter sets in. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
South Africa has declined an appeal from the European Union to try to persuade Russia to end its war in Ukraine. EU Vice President and Foreign Minister Josep Borrell made the call on Friday at the end of the 15th South Africa European Ministerial Meeting. Pretoria has a close relationship with Moscow, largely based on the former Soviet Union's support for the now governing African National Congress's fight against apartheid. Darren Taylor reports.
South Africa is the continent's second largest and most industrialized economy. It's the only African country to have membership in the powerful G20 bloc. It's one of the continent's strongest democracies and is a leading voice calling for Africa to have a permanent seat on the UN Security Council. South Africa is also a member of the BRICS bloc of the world's strongest emerging economies, a group that includes Russia. Borrell said the EU isn't asking any African country to choose between Russia and Ukraine, but to stand on the side of the UN Charter to uphold peace and security, which they'd signed.
And the European Union regards South Africa as an important partner to uphold and to reinvigorate a rules-based international order. This is why I very much hope that South Africa will use its good relations with Russia to convince Russia to stop this senseless war.
South Africa's Minister of International Relations, Naledi Pandor, responded that the world, not just her country, should work towards a negotiated outcome in the war in Eastern Europe. She suggested that the UN system, particularly its Security Council, should be reformed in order to have a global mechanism that has legitimacy to better handle complex global problems.
We need to ensure, as we reform the United Nations, that all countries and all people's voices are heard, and that multilateral bodies do not become a place for privilege, but a place for promoting sovereign equality of all and not just some.
Senior government officials later told VOA it was unfair of Borrell to expect South Africa to interfere. They described his appeal as unreasonable, saying it represented undue pressure on President Cyril Ramaphosa's administration. University of Pretoria international relations expert Professor Chris Isike agrees.
It must not be pressured unnecessarily beyond its abilities and its own interests also to do any of these things. However, I maintain that South Africa must show character of consistency with its principles, and back its words with action.
Isike says consistency and character are missing from South Africa's contradictory stance on the Ukraine war.
It is a contradiction to say that South Africa is neutral, but then is planning to engage in military drills with Russia, deliberately timed by Russia to coincide with its invasion of Ukraine.
He says Pretoria keeps on saying it wants peace and negotiation and respects the UN Charter, yet it will not condemn an attack on a sovereign nation.
It's a contradiction to frown against the Western strategy of regime change, such as they did in Iraq or Libya, and then be silent about Russia's strategy of removing the current government in Kyiv.
Isike says South Africa is telling the world it wants to be friends with everyone, but this isn't how real life works. Sometimes, he says, a country has to make enemies by taking principled positions to find out who its true friends are. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish. It was a deadly weekend in Ukraine's east. For the latest, we turn to our reporter in Kyiv, Anna Chernikova.
Over the weekend, Ukraine experienced some really bad shelling, especially in the east and in the south regions. Particularly, we are talking about the city of Kherson and the city of Kharkiv. So the city of Kherson is constantly under the shelling. This is important also to understand, because the city itself located on one side of the river Dnipro, and Russian forces are located just on the other side. Over the weekend, it was a really bad shelling of the residential buildings, hospital, and school in the city of Kherson. But the worst situation is with the residential buildings and with the hospital. For the moment, we know about three people who were killed and six injured. We know that one person is currently in the very serious state. Yesterday evening, shocking news came from the city of Kharkiv, and it was a very big scare that it could be something similar to to the tragedies that happened in the city of Dnipro, because one of the Russian missiles hit the residential building. For the moment, we know that there is at least one person killed. At least 15 residents of the building were evacuated.
And over the weekend, Mykhailo Podlyak asked that Ukraine's allies start considering sending Ukraine airplanes. Do you think that will be the next conversation for the West to have in terms of supporting Ukraine?
Well, this is exactly what President Zelensky also said. So I presume that Mr. Podolak, he was kind of supporting this statement by President Zelensky, because President Zelensky, after the latest Rammstein meeting, he announced that after this tank decision, tank coalition, he announced that next major discussion for Ukraine would be airplanes. And also what we're hearing, that actually Poland was considering to send some, and there are also some countries that basically discuss this. But again, as Prime Minister of Poland said, that this only possible, again, in coalition with NATO countries, so in similar coalition as happened to the tank decision. Yeah, so basically this is something which is actively discussed within Ukraine. And also, this discussion starts on the international level because, as I already said, President Zelensky made it clear that this would be one of the main topics for the next Rammstein meeting.
Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Steve.
Congressman Mike Quigley is a Democratic representative from Illinois. He sat down with Katerina Lisunova of VOA's Ukrainian service last week. They spoke about supplying Ukraine with more weapons and planning for a spring offensive from Russia.
Do you support providing Ukraine with fighter jets?
Yes.
Why?
For the same reason I just outlined. You can't win a war with half measures. And I'm not suggesting that we have, but when the members of the RADA came over and addressed us, it was very powerful. It was a time when it was the five women who came over, and they showed us alerts on their phones that there was a missile attack coming, and they had kids there. It was very powerful. And one of them said something that really struck with me. We were talking about humanitarian aid. She said, right now, weaponry is humanitarian aid. So I went out in the hallway and I said something. It was a little harsh. I said, you can't half-ass a war. It's like, not very artful. But I think it took a while for the West and the United States to say they could win. And you can't let Putin win by his threats, saying, you're escalating. You have to be mindful of this. You have to keep diplomacy open. So my attitude is, so far, I've said this weekly since the war began, and we're getting there. But you have to give Ukraine the weaponry. You can't say, well, we'll give you this and not that, because it just makes the war last longer and provides openings to Putin.
Right now everybody talking about Russian counteroffensive, which is supposed to be massive, and some people say brutal. What do you think the plan of Western world should be right now? How to act right now to prevent that, to act against that?
I'm not a military strategist, tactician. I think that Ukraine, if I'm in Ukraine in leadership, I listen to the best and brightest from the West, right? In the end, you have to make those decisions. But I think the good news is there's some time for preparation, and you have some of the best military minds in the world who will help you address how to handle this situation. So now more than ever, you know this is coming. Be ready. And I think an element of surprise from Ukraine in how they respond or act in a way that isn't expected. But again, out of my field with military expertise, my goal would be to make sure they have access to the best equipment, the best people, and that in the meantime we're helping protect Ukraine as much as possible. You know, when in Israel, we think of this Iron Dome. Now, that's a specific kind of defense. We have to think about a virtual Iron Dome over as much of Ukraine and its critical infrastructure as we possibly can. So the addition of Patriots was one part of this. But there's all kinds of short, mid, and long-range kind of missile defense systems. Helping Ukraine coordinate that in the most effective means possible, again, beyond my pay grade and knowledge, but that has to be a priority as well. Because you would imagine there would be an onslaught and then the offensive.
That's Democratic Congressman Mike Quigley of Illinois speaking with Katerina Lisinova of VOA's Ukrainian service. We've all been there, on the phone with tech support, getting help for our electronic devices or logging on to one of our accounts. But what if we were fighting a war? AP correspondent Sarah Naffa reports.
an expanding U.S. military helpline aimed at providing repair advice to Ukrainian forces in the heat of battle, has turned to virtual chat rooms. Using phones and tablets to communicate in encrypted chat lines, a rapidly growing group of U.S. and allied troops and contractors are providing real-time maintenance advice to Ukrainian troops on the battlefield. As allies send more and increasingly complex high-tech weapons to Ukraine, demands for these services are spiking, particularly as no U.S. or other NATO nations will send troops into the country to provide hands-on assistance, amid worries about being drawn into direct conflict with Russia. Fixing a howitzer, repair teams say, has been a frequent request from Ukrainian troops on the front lines. Just a few months ago, there were a bit more than 50 members of these remote maintenance teams. That will surge to 150 in the coming weeks, and the number of encrypted chat lines has more than tripled, from about 11 last fall to 38 now. I'm Sarah Naffa.
We've heard a lot about tanks lately on this program. A lot. Who didn't want to send them and who did. We've heard where they're going and where they're needed. But we've heard less about the tanks themselves and the differences between them. With the U.S. now joining Germany and Britain in promising to send battle tanks to Ukraine, what are the capabilities and differences among the three types of tanks that will join the fight? VOA's Steve Reddish takes a look and shows us around.
Powered by a 1,500-horsepower engine, America's Abrams M1 tank is widely considered the most technologically sophisticated tank in use. A crew of four operates the M1. It is equipped with a 120mm smoothbore cannon used to destroy enemy tanks and other heavily armored vehicles. The Abrams also has three machine guns, a heavy one to take out lightly armored vehicles, and a pair of lighter ones that are considered anti-personnel weapons. It can move at a top speed of around 65 kilometers per hour, with a maximum driving range of about 425 kilometers. The Abrams M1 turbine engine runs best on jet fuel, which adds to the expense and logistics to operate it. Germany's Leopard 2 uses the more available diesel fuel to power its 1,500-horsepower turbocharged engine. The Leopard 2 has many of the Abrams M1 features, such as the 120mm smoothbore cannon and a pair of light machine guns. The German and U.S. tanks are designed to better protect its four-person crew than the Soviet-made tanks that both Ukraine and Russia are currently using. John Gentile is a former U.S. Army tank commander and military historian with the RAND Corporation.
So the M1A1 tanks, along with the Leopard 2s, the crew is much safer because the ammunition for those two types of tanks are outside of the where the crew is sitting in the turret. And so if an M1 tank or a Leopard 2 tank is hit and everything is right in the turret, the rounds go up and out. Whereas on a T-72 tank, the rounds are inside the turret with the crew, and they're much more prone to be set off and cause catastrophic damage to the tank crew and the tank itself.
With a crew of four, the Leopard 2 has a similar maximum speed as the Abrams, but its range is about 340 kilometers. Availability is the Leopard's biggest asset. More than 2,000 are spread throughout multiple European countries. Britain's Challenger 2 has a 120mm rifle gun as its main weapon, along with a couple of light machine guns, like the other tanks. And its ammunition is also stored outside the crew compartment. Its diesel-fueled engine is smaller, 1,200 horsepower, and the Challenger 2 does not move as fast as the others. But its maximum driving range of more than 500 kilometers is significantly better than either the U.S. or German-made tanks. Steve Reddish, VOA News.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice of America. Washington, ba 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 zip. DC.